Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about SIMD or vector instructions. The basic idea here was we'd have a wider ALU and wider registers that would hold a little array of values, and we'd act on all of them at once. And that this would let us support more computation with basically the same logic as far as executing instructions, forwarding, and so on. And this is something that all these modern processors are implementing to expose more computation to users. We talked about Intel's interface for if you wanted to write C code, but specify these SIMD instructions manually, which we said you might want to do because compilers are very variable about whether they'll figure out whether to do this because of issues like aliasing. Then we talked about our next topic, which is about how processors help with the OS. So one thing that happens on a real computer is you run multiple programs at once, potentially like 20 programs, even though you don't have 20 cores probably. And the way this works is that somehow you have to share the CPU. And we learned that the OS takes care of doing that. So the OS gets to run at some point, and it removes a program from the processor by taking what we called its context, its registers, condition codes, program counter, and saving them somewhere in the OS's memory. And then the OS restores the context of some other program and starts running it. And this we call a context switch. And in order to have these context switches happen, even if our program doesn't do anything, so we had the example of a program that just runs an infinite loop forever, if you run that on a lab machine, you'd hope someone else could still use the machine. The way we make that possible is we have exceptions, where the processor starts running the OS, even though the things it's running, the instructions, don't contain anything which says, please run the OS here. They just contain normal instructions, but the processor just runs the OS in the middle of that, despite what the actual instructions say. And we'll talk more about exceptions today, what kinds of exceptions there are, the details of how that mechanism where the processor starts running the OS works, and some other things related to how we build processes. This notion of a program that's running, which kind of seems like it owns the machine, more about how the OS maintains that illusion. So we learn about how it maintains that illusion for a CPU. When the OS switches you off the CPU and back on, it kind of looks like you own the CPU the whole time, it just ran at a weird speed. We'll talk about other things we need to maintain that illusion that you kind of have the whole machine when you're running, even though multiple things are running conceptually at the same time. So first, some logistical notes. So there's a final. Our final is in Wilson 402. This is on the schedule. It's on the 10th of May at 7 p.m. If you can't make the final, please fill out the conflict form, which I sent an email out about a while ago, and so I linked off the schedule page real soon. Because if you don't, I might not have a time for you to take the final. So there's a lab this week. The lab this week involves SIMD. So these vector instructions. And it's a preview for the smooth homework. If you don't understand the lab, you will probably have problems on the homework. There are some optional parts in the lab. They are optional because some students take a really long time on the earlier parts. Some students understand what's going on, get it pretty quickly. So we made them optional because we want to have the lab be a size that we expect pretty much everyone to finish in 75 minutes. But I would recommend trying them just to get comfortable for the smooth assignment because we can tell you more about what the actual solution is to the lab than we can to the homework. On Thursday, we can show you a solution for all parts of the lab, which is not going to happen for the homework, obviously. And a note on smooth. Most students take considerably more time to do smooth than rotate. Not everyone. It depends on basically, if you do a bunch of things in rotate that don't work, you might take more time, but for the most part, people need a lot more time for smooth, so please start early, especially if you don't know what's going on in the lab, you probably should start early. So you have time to talk to TAs and so on. Okay. So that's all my logistical notes. And when we finished off last time, we talked about time multiplexing. This idea of sharing the CPU where we'd switch from one program to another And we said that the mechanism where the OS got to run was an exception, and the OS was responsible for changing between two different things that would run. And the information the OS changed, we called a context. So we said a context was all the register values. It also had to be the condition code. So you think we're running a loop, an exception happens. When we go back to running that old program, it better be the case that if the exception happened to happen just before a conditional jump, that the conditional jump does the same thing it would have done otherwise. So the OS needs to save the condition codes. We need to save the program counter. We need to go back to the exact instruction we stopped on if we're stopping a program at some random point. And you can think of this that this is all the visible state in our CPU besides memory. So if you think of like our Y86 processor, it doesn't include like the pipeline registers, but everything that you as a programmer could extract, it's there. So you can figure out what the PC is by like calling something. You can figure out what the condition codes are by like trying all the possible jumps or all the possible conditional moves. So all this state is visible to you, whereas something like the pipeline register values, you can't like directly figure it out. You can't like write instructions that figure out what the pipeline registers were. So to save this context, the code in the OS that gets run is going to look something like this, that we copy the PC, which I'm going to say we need some special instruction to do, and then we save all the registers somewhere, and then we restore the registers to some other program. So what happens is before we have our exception, it's like our timer goes off and we decide I've run this loop for too long. We have one program on our CPU, and that program is running. It has some pointers to its memory, like it's running code in its memory, it's using stack, and it's part of the memory. And then we have a context switch happen, and the OS copies everything that was on the CPU into the OS's memory and puts onto the CPU values something for another process, process B. So program A was running, then program B starts running. And program B's pointers point to its memory, and it gets to run until the OS again decides to switch back. So this is the basic idea of context switches. The OS, while something's not on the CPU, stores everything that would be on the CPU inside its own memory, and then swaps between those to run multiple programs, have them share one CPU over time. Okay. So sharing the CPU is the most important sort of aspect of this notion of a process, of a program that is running. And when we share the CPU like this, as far as program A and B are concerned, it looks like we have our own CPU, basically, because we can't change the values of anyone else's CPU, so it's ours. So let's talk about memory. That's the other big thing that we said wasn't part of the context. So if I was running this program on a normal computer system, so I have 42, stored initially in memory at address 10,000 in program A, and at some point I move the value at that address into RAX. If nothing happens, that's going to be 42. And I have some other program which writes to that address, say 99. What value is program A going to see in RAX? Who has an idea? What would you expect? Yeah?
It should still see 40. Ideally, it should still see 42.
So you say, I think it would make most sense if it still sees 42. And why is that?
Because in its own program context, it expects 42 to be there, and its running shouldn't be affected by another program running at the same time.
So our intuition is that, my program behaves independently. I see the code in my assembly file, and that's all my program does. And that's the notion we're used to. You don't expect that because you're running on a shared lab machine that the values in your memory are going to be different than if you were running on your own laptop. And this is a property that we have to make some effort to maintain, because if we imagine there's just the natural thing happening and the context switch happening the way I just told you, then what would happen is that we change to program B, these instructions run, and it changes that value in memory. And when I told you what was in a context, I said, well, memory values aren't included. And it makes sense that you wouldn't include them because we want to switch between contexts really fast. Like, we're doing this milliseconds, copying megabytes of memory is not a good idea if you want to be fast for that. And in fact, if you run this, your result on a typical operating system is going to be that it's always 42. And program B, well, either it's going to not complain at all, or it might crash. It might say, you're accessing address 10,000. That's not an address you told me about. And your program's going to crash. And we're going to talk about the mechanism that makes that happen. But first, let's talk about this idea of memory in general. So we talked about how we share the CPU, but we also need to consider sharing memory. So I showed you this picture way back of what the use of addresses in a program on Linux typically looks like. So we have some fixed location where we typically put our code, followed by global variables, followed by our heap, and we have our stack at some roughly fixed location. And let's say we have two programs are running. We're context switching between program A and program B, and you know they both follow the same convention for laying out their memory. So this means that over here, program A has some code, and program B has some hopefully different code because it's a different program. And based on this picture, they're at the same memory address. And that clearly isn't actually possible. We can't have a real machine where we send something to the data memory and we get different values. There's only one thing at each memory address. So how is this implemented? This is what it's going to appear like. It's going to appear that program A has some memory layout. It can choose whatever things in memory, wherever it likes, basically. And program B does the same thing using the same addresses and has the same addresses in its assembly code, and it still works. And these run at the same time, and we don't do something like copy all the memory of program A somewhere when we switch to program B and back again, because that would be really, really expensive. So this idea that each program has this independent memory is what our book calls an address space. Each program has its own address space. Each program's notion of what every memory address is independent and defined for just that program. You can think of this as the illusion of their own memory. So the switching between different things on a CPU gave each program the illusion they had their own CPU, it just behaved kind of weirdly. We're going to give programs the illusion they have their own memory, it just has some peculiar holes and doesn't, you know, have the full size of all the memory on the machine. And the way we implement this in a typical processor is that there's this mapping between addresses the program uses and real memory addresses. And that's going to be set by the OS. And as we'll learn later, that mapping, the form we're going to use for it is going to be a page table. So it's a particular way of representing that mapping. But for now, it's sufficient to know that there's some mapping between program addresses and real addresses. And we'll call the program addresses that have this mapping are going to be called virtual addresses. And the real addresses we'll sometimes call physical addresses. And this mapping is also going to explain a bunch of other things that our OS does as far as what our memory looks like. So you're probably familiar with the fact that, well, not all of the program's memory does anything. So there's these holes, like the space between the stack and the heap. And what do you expect to happen if you try to write to memory in these regions? Yeah. You get a segfault. So somehow our mapping not only represents that we have a place where we find our code, a place where we find our data, based on taking the actual address of the code that the program sees and translating it to some real address that's different for these two programs. We also have an option that our mapping can say, though that memory address range doesn't correspond to anything, it should trigger an error. And by trigger an error, we're going to actually mean an exception. We'll talk about that in a bit. So we have this mapping set up. And it has some representation. And this is part of what the OS will change during the context switch. So our context is going to have the registers, the PC, the condition codes, the state on the CPU itself, plus some representation of the memory of the program, which is going to be this mapping. So we're not going to actually store the entire contents of memory of the program. We're just going to store the mapping and switch between the different mappings when we switch between programs. So the mechanism for this is going to be, as I said, virtual memory. But it's what we change in a context switch. So where previously I said everything but memory, that's not true. It's going to be all the register values, the condition codes, the program counter, and the address space, which is going to be switched by changing the map from virtual addresses, program addresses, to real physical addresses. And that's part of what we're going to store in a context switch and restore when we switch back to a program. And when we put the two things we're doing together, so we started with time multiplexing, where we switch the CPU from one program to another and preserved all the registers and the other values the program was working with on the CPU, and where we keep the memory the same, where we have this address space that a program has and typically doesn't intersect with another program's address space, which gives them the illusion they have all the memory and they can put things in memory wherever they like without worrying about interfering with other programs. Together, this is called a process. So that illusion of an own CPU is sometimes known as a thread. So a thread just means that you think you have your own CPU, even if it's implemented by sharing a CPU. So that's a thread, that virtual CPU you have where you keep running and you get switched around, but each one of those is a thread. And the address space you can think of as sort of a virtual memory, the illusion you have your own memory that is independent of everything else that is running. Even though it's implemented by subdividing the real memory and giving you access to selected pieces of it. Just like we implement a thread by subdividing the real CPUs and giving you access to parts of the CPUs in time. And this is most of the job of an operating system. So when you think about an operating system, probably the biggest thing it's doing is managing processes. It's deciding, making multiple programs run, deciding when they run, deciding what resources they get. It's managing this abstraction. So any questions about the processes or address spaces before I move on to talk about exceptions? Have some overlap with this. Okay. So we talked about what we do when we switch between programs, and we said that the mechanism for that was exceptions. And I gave one example of a case where we have an exception, and that's where something's been running for too long, and we want the OS to run and possibly switch to something else. But there are a whole bunch of other kinds of exceptions. And we're going to talk about sort of a taxonomy of this based on what our book does. This is not the only possible taxonomy, but it's a useful one. And I'm going to start with the highest level sort of way of separating the kinds of exceptions our book has. So our book calls some exceptions synchronous. And these are things which are triggered by a particular instruction, where we can look at the program and say, because you ran this assembly instruction, an exception happened and the processor just started to run the OS. And the other kind are asynchronous ones. So these are ones where we can't look at any particular instruction and decide that's why this exception happened. And this is the example of the timer one. Like, it's not because I was running an infinite loop that the timer exception happened. There's no instruction in that loop I can point to and say that caused an exception to happen. It's just that after I run for too long, whatever's running, we don't care, an exception happened and started the OS to let it switch away from my program. So these are our high-level categories, and we're going to further subdivide both of these categories into some more, simpler types. And I'm going to use the names our book uses, which are interrupts, faults, traps, and aborts. I note that I'm not super happy with this division in the book, mostly because of this last category, aborts, which is a reasonable category, but other sources would lump that in with one or more of the other ones. And it, to be fair, is probably the least important of this category for understanding what like operating systems do. Okay, so let's start with Runtapa. So interrupts are the name we're going to give to anything externally triggered. So this is all our asynchronous exceptions, pretty much. And the example we've seen so far is what's known as a timer interrupt, where we want to keep the program from hogging the CPU, so when it's run for too long, we arrange for an interrupt to happen. And the way this works is that there's an external timer device. I say external, I mean conceptually external. Like it's on the physical die of the processor generally, but it's not part of the CPU proper as far as how the OS talks to it and how it communicates with the processor. So the OS can send a message to this saying, hey timer, I want you to set off an alarm in 5 milliseconds. So the OS does that, and then it starts running a program. Then 5 milliseconds later, the timer says, okay, alarm time, and it sends the signal to the CPU saying, there's an alarm, you should tell the OS about it. And the CPU acts on that by starting to run the OS. And this is how the operating system arranges to make sure it doesn't let any program run forever. It configures this external timer, conceptually external timer, so an interrupt happens when the program's run for long enough. The OS gets to run, and it makes a decision at that point, do I have something else to run, or do I want to keep running the same program, and so on. So the other major category, which we've also seen, is faults. So we said that when you access memory you weren't supposed to, it triggered an error. And triggering an error is not really an operation which makes sense to do as far as inside a program itself, because if you think of a program, so an error happened, I accessed the wrong memory, what instruction do I run? Like, the answer isn't any instruction in that program. So what we do when we trigger an error like that, like you access memory you weren't supposed to, is that we ask the OS what to do. So you've seen the word segmentation fault, that's the OS and your shell reporting back to you that an error happened, and you know, I didn't know what to do. And typically what happens is that we have a fault, which is the processor detects that an error happened. It runs the OS, says, hey OS, the program that you were letting run had this, you know, did something it wasn't supposed to. What do you want to do? And the OS does whatever it wants to do. And typically what we've seen it do is get rid of the program. Just crash the program and get rid of it. The program can't do it itself, the processor can't do it because the program has data stored in the OS memory that the OS needs to take care of. So it asks the OS, you know, something bad happened, do what you want to do about it. And we have this third category known as traps. So these are intentionally triggered exceptions. And by intentionally triggered, I don't mean it's like I wrote assembly that I knew accessed invalid memory. I mean we were doing something which it only makes sense for causing an exception. So typically when we say something is a trap, we mean that there is an instruction we used whose only purpose and only functionality is causing an exception to happen. And almost all processors have such instructions whose only functionality is that they cause an exception to happen. They cannot possibly do anything else. And we use one of those instructions. And the most common use is to ask the OS to do something. And probably the most common example of asking the OS to do something is when I want to do I/O, when I want to, say, read input from the keyboard. So I have my program that's reading input, and it's going to involve two of these kinds of exceptions. So first, my program is running, and I decide I'm going to read from the keyboard. And I'm not going to take care of that myself. I'm going to want the OS to do it for me. And part of the reason for that is that, well, there's not input right now. I want the OS to wake me up when there is. So I'm going to make this read what we call a system call, a call to the operating system, using a trap. And we'll talk later about why can't I just use a function call, but there's going to be a reason I can't. So I'm going to use a trap, trigger an exception, to run the OS, telling it somehow, I want to read from the keyboard. And the OS is going to say, okay, you want to read from the keyboard, let me check the keyboard, does it have any input right now? Nope. And so the OS is going to say, well, I can't give you the input from the keyboard right now, so I'm just going to run something else for a while. So it switches to another program, and maybe another program. And eventually, the user presses a key on the keyboard. And that causes the keyboard to send a signal to the processor saying, hey, processor, I have input for you if you want it. And the processor turns that signal into an exception. This is known as an interrupt because it's caused by an external event, namely I/O. So the processor triggers an interrupt that the OS gets to interpret, and the OS gets to run, so it says, okay, what kind of exception is this? Oh, it's an interrupt from the keyboard. Let me check who was waiting for keyboard input. And it finds out, oh, back here I recorded that readinput.exe was waiting for keyboard input, so that's program probably should run now. So it says, okay, it was waiting for keyboard input, let me get that keyboard input for it and return back and start running it again. And so we can see this process with two exceptions. So one where triggered by the program intentionally, where it says, I want the OS to wait for keyboard input for me. And the other where our external device, our keyboard, tells the OS, I have input for you. You know, if you want to handle it now, you should stop whatever you're doing and do that. And the processor helps the OS do that by causing an exception to happen and therefore running the OS no matter what that purple program was doing. Any questions about this process? And all sorts of I/O devices are going to have this sort of pattern. So when we read from keyboards, we're going to get exceptions. When we read from hard drives, you know, we're going to tell the hard drive, hey, I want to read something. It's going to come back to us saying, okay, I have your data now. It's going to come back with an interrupt, so we can run other things while we're waiting for the I/O device to work. And this is going to be true for pretty much anything we do with an I/O device. Same thing with like a network device. Like I get a packet on my Wi-Fi card. The way that works is that there's some separate thing that's that Wi-Fi controller that processes the packet and then it sends a signal to the CPU, so the CPU can start the OS and say, hey, there's something that came in on the network if you want to deal with it now. And the OS can start running and say, maybe I'll tell the browser, here's some data. But interrupts are how we get the OS to run when I/O is ready, but let other things happen while we're waiting for that. So we also have this mystical fourth category, which I said, I don't really like the book including it so much. So this is for things where basically something is wrong with our hardware. So the most common case for what our book calls an abort is probably something where we detect that a hardware component is actually broken. So for example, some memory has extra bits to keep track of whether data got corrupted. And in cases where data gets corrupted, for example, because the memory chip is broken or because of radiation, the memory chip can detect this and signal the CPU and tell the CPU, hey, I don't know what data I was supposed to be storing. And this kind of signal gets manifested in what our textbook calls an abort. So it starts running the OS saying what our book authors often call the machine check exception, saying something is broken. And the OS gets to decide what to do. These are different than these other kinds of exceptions, because our options as the OS are not great. Like, if I know I have wrong values in my memory, like not the values I stored are there anymore, and what can I do? My options are basically crash or login. But we still want to have that mechanism because certainly we don't want to just ignore it. You know, we want to at least log it so maybe some system administrator can realize, oh, I probably should replace this memory chip that keeps doing this. So aborts are for that kind of hardware problem, where something is wrong with the hardware and the OS needs to deal with it. And it's not clear whether you should call them synchronous or asynchronous, because they can be both. The memory chip might only notice that values are wrong when you try to read from it, and it looks at its check bits, and it finds out, these don't agree. And so it might be triggered by a particular instruction, or it could be happen asynchronously. Okay. So any questions about these types of exceptions, why we have these categories? Okay, so let's talk about what we need to do to implement exceptions. Then there's two sides of this. So there's one side where we're making a chip and we want to make the hardware that actually implements exceptions. And there's the other side where we're writing an operating system and we want to handle exceptions. And we're gonna have to do some things which are a little bit unusual in both cases. So from the chip's point of view, there are three basic tasks we have to do. So one is we have to somehow detect that an exception condition occurred. And remember that we had two kinds. So for the synchronous exceptions, where there's a particular instruction, this is going to just be some normal control signal. So just like we detect that we have to take a jump, we're going to detect that we have an exception caused by an instruction. And basically, instead of advancing to the next instruction after it, we're going to advance to the OS. We're just going to have some different logic run, just like what you do for a conditional jump. It's just extra case in our control logic. In the case where you have an external event, there's going to be some physical wires coming into the processor. And every time we would fetch an instruction, we're going to also look at those wires. And if they're raised, so they say, yes, there's an external event you have to worry about, we're going to not fetch the normal next instruction, but we're going to go to the OS. So once we've detected that this happens, we need to do the actual process of starting the OS code. And there are two big things we need to do for that. First, the processor has to save the value of the PC somewhere. It might also save other stuff, but we definitely need to save the PC because this next step here overwrites the PC. So if we didn't save the PC, we're going to lose it. And that's really bad if you think about our timer interrupt case. I'm writing a loop, a timer interrupt happens, I run the OS. The OS decides, oh, no other programs to run, I want to go back to that. Well, it can't go back if it doesn't know what the PC was. So we absolutely need to save the PC somewhere. We'll talk about what the options for where are in a bit. And then we need to jump to the exception handler. Just set the PC to the location of the exception handler. And this is executed like a jump instruction, but there's no real jump instruction. It's a fake jump instruction that we make up out of whole cloth because, well, there might not be any instruction in the program meant to do that, like if we have an interrupt, some external event happened, the timer went off, or I pressed a key. There's no instruction actually saying to go there. The processor needs to synthesize the same operation. Okay, so I'm going to talk about one version of implementing sort of the hardware to OS interface. This is simplified. What our textbook describes is also simplified. Real x86-64 has a bunch of extra complicated things that just basically add in direction and don't, which will change all the terms used. I mean, the layout of memory isn't what I'm showing you, but it's basically the same ideas, just with a few extra pieces of indirection and bigger table entries and so on. But just as a warning, if you try to look up this for real, you're going to see slightly different things and different terminology. So the basic idea on most systems for finding the exception handler is we need to have some place to look for it. And the most common strategy is we're going to have a table in memory with pointers to lots of exception handlers. The reason we want lots of them is, well, what the OS wants to do for a divide by zero and a timer interrupt is very different. You know, for a timer interrupt, it's, okay, what program do I want to run next? For a divide by zero, it's, okay, how do I get terminate this program and tell the thing that was running it about that? Very different tasks. And to help the OS, you know, figure out what to do without like checking something, we have a table with one entry for each kind of exception. And we have a special register known as the exception table base register that points to the beginning of that table. And the processor, when it detects an exception, it's going to know what kind of exception it detected, and it's going to access the appropriate entry to the table, and that's where it's going to jump to. And we have this exception table base register, and this is going to be set by a special instruction. So we'll add this special register and an instruction to set it. And the OS is going to do that as part of boot up. So our procedure now is that we save the old program counter. Maybe we save some other stuff, but at least the old program counter. Then we look in that table for the exception handler based on the kind of exception we detected. So there's one entry for each kind. And then we jump to that location. Then the OS gets to run, and it can do whatever it likes. It can save anything it needs to save. It can update the registers to load another program, and so on. Okay. So what do we need to actually add to the CPU? So we're going to need to add a new instruction and the logic to take advantage of the exception table. So we need a new instruction to bind the exception table base and to set that. So that's a new instruction in our instruction set. We need some logic to jump based on the exception table. When we detect an exception, we need to actually have hardware that can look up a value in memory to find out the address in the exception table and go there. We need logic to save the old PC, and we need to save it somewhere. And there's basically two options. We can save it to a special register. So we can add a special register, you know, which means we need instructions to read from OS. Or we can save it to memory, which means, you know, we need to choose where, like on a stack, you know, fixed location, you know, we choose some place in memory. As long as the OS knows where it is, we can just save it there in memory. But we have to save it somewhere. And we also, it turns out, are going to need a new instruction to return from an exception. That it's not going to be good enough to just know that we have a jump instruction. So let's start off with the easy reason why the most obvious thing here doesn't work. So why can't I just say move saved PC into RAX and then jump RAX? What's wrong with doing that? Why is that not a way I can return to my exception handler back to the saved program counter? Yeah?
Maybe the handler uses RAX?
So the handler may have used RAX, but fortunately we just stopped, whereas this is the end of it.
Oh, that's
but it is a related issue, yeah.
It may have used all of the other components of like the registers or condition things. This doesn't reset those back to what they need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the main problem is not that the handler may have used REX, but that the code we're returning to may have used REX. Remember that when an exception happens, there's no calling convention for like an interrupt. I pressed a key, anything could be running, any register could be used. Like I could be writing code that used REX or 14, there's no register that's safe to use for this because all of them could have been used by whatever was interrupted. Wherever I pressed the key or wherever the timer happened, they could all be used. So we can't do this because, you know, used by interrupted program. So less obvious is why I can't do a RET. So you might say, okay, I could just push the address to return to on the stack and then return. And this seems like this would work, but it turns out that that's not an option either. And there's two reasons for that. So one of them is related to protection, which we'll talk about later. Another is that we really care about this illusion of a dedicated CPU and memory. And when we care about that, you want to, your program, think it really owns the CPU and the memory and can do whatever it wants that the instruction set supports. And that means that you don't have to follow the calling convention. Like, if your program doesn't follow the calling convention and you run it, you still expect it to work as long as everything in your program follows that alternate calling convention. So you might not use the stack the way we expect. You might access things below the stack pointer. And that's fine. And the OS needs to make sure that that works. So it's also not an option to use the return instruction, because the OS has to assume that if you write this program, I need to run it right. And right is that you don't get to notice that there's anything else running. And that means I can't manipulate the things which are off your stack. I need to make that still work. So we're going to have a special instruction to deal with that, which is going to set the PC from some other location, not in the normal ways we've seen. And there's going to be reasons related to protection while we really need that, which we'll get to later. Okay, so we've talked about the hardware for implementing exception handler running. Let's talk about what the OS is going to do. So the basic structure of our exception handler is, first, we have something where we save all the processes' state. Note that because every register could be in use, we need to save all the registers, not just the ones that we would normally consider callee saved. We need to save all the registers, they're all in use, they all need to have their value placed somewhere. Then we do our work to handle the exception, and that depends on the kind of exception. So for a timer interrupt, we say, what process do I want to run next? For like a divide by zero, we say, let's get rid of this process and inform the program that was running it. And there's other options for other exceptions. After we do that work, we restore a process's state. And in the case where we're switching between programs, where we're doing a context switch, we might restore a different process's state. We might not restore the one we started with. And then we return from the exception. And in this case, I'm saying, hypothetically, we have this special register that stores the saved program counter, and that's what a return from exception instruction uses. So we want to switch to a different program, we use a special instruction to load that. Okay. And an additional part of that is going to be setting our address space. So, given that we know that when I'm running, say, my infinite loop here, I have a timer interrupt, the exception table runs, we do all those steps, and the reason my loop doesn't keep running forever is that the last step restores the state of, in this case, ssh.exe, so we set the address space, we set the save PC, we also set all the registers up here, and then we return from exception. So you might say, okay, that's cute, that's nice, you kept me from running my infinite loop, but I have a better idea. This timer interrupt handler is keeping me from running my loop forever, which is keeping me from hogging the lab machines. Maybe I can fix that, by just, setting my own exception table. And my exception table has this much better timer interrupt handler. Its timer interrupt handler just returns, doesn't change any registers, just returns back to where we were, keeps running my infinite loop. So what's going to happen if I, write this program with the real instructions for this? Obviously, it's not actually called set exception table base, because you haven't seen x86 be that good at naming instructions. If I run this program with the real instructions and table layout for this, what do you think is going to happen? I write this program, compile it, can definitely write the instructions the OS uses to set the exception table, so on. What's going to happen? Yeah. Yeah, so you have this notion of kernel mode, that I, as a mere user, am not allowed to use these instructions. And that's, in fact, what will happen. So if I use the instruction to set the exception table base, which is on x86 is LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table, I try to use that. The result is segmentation fault. Sorry. And this is the idea of privileged instructions, that we don't want to let normal programs do certain instructions. And this is essential to allowing us to share machines. So we think about the lab servers. Because I can't do that, that means that I can't hog all the CPU. Like, I can't use the OS's mechanism and subvert it to kick over the CPU. The OS always gets control no matter what I do. So examples of exceptions that will gate this way include setting the exception table, setting our address space. This is needed so I can't read the text your text editor is displaying, because it's your text editor, not mine. Talking to I/O devices. So we don't want it to be the case that I can read from the disk your files. So the OS is the only thing that's going to be allowed to read from the disk. Also, the only thing allowed to talk to the keyboard, so the OS decides what program is actually running on the keyboard, and so on. And to make this work, we have this notion of kernel mode. So the processor is going to have two modes it runs in. In kernel mode, privileged instructions work. In user mode, privileged instructions instead cause an exception. And in this case, it caused an exception. That exception went to the OS. The OS said, that's nice. I'm just going to kill this program. So it killed the program, told the program that was running it, hey, I killed this program for a fault. And that's why we got the message segmentation fault printed out. The thing that was running it learned that from the OS it was killed for the fault and printed out that message for me. So in our processor, to implement kernel mode, we have this extra 1-bit register. Are we in kernel mode? And the way we're going to manage that with exceptions is that every exception is going to enter kernel mode. And the return from exception instruction, the bigger reason why we can't just use a normal return or jump, is that it's going to leave kernel mode. So it's going to be our mechanism to go back to user mode where these privileged instructions don't work. So this means that when we have an exception happen and the OS is running, it gets to change address spaces and access I/O devices and adjust the exception table base register and so on. But whenever it returns back to a user mode program, all those operations are prohibited. And if you try to do them, it just runs the OS instead, and the OS decides what to do instead. Typically, we've seen our OSs decide just crash the program that tried to do it. But they could hypothetically decide something else. So something related to this, you might wonder, is, so we have this special mode where these instructions work, but we're jumping to the handler which contains these instructions. Why can't I just overwrite that handler? And if we look at our memory layout, I've had this part at the top labeled used by OS. And this is, in fact, where in memory the exception handlers live. They're in memory at a particular address that is mapped in that mapping. So the question is, what's stopping me from changing that? What's stopping me from, instead of changing the exception table base register, just change the actual code, machine code of the timer interrupt handler to just be a return? And the answer is that when I showed you the address space idea, we were missing a component. That in addition to saying that some addresses go to errors or some addresses go to a particular place in real memory, we have two kinds of ways addresses can go to places in real memory. One kind, which I'm representing with a dotted line, we say this address goes to this part of memory, but only in kernel mode. In the other modes, it's triggering error. And this is, in fact, what our Linux does with this region of memory. So this region of memory, it's mapped. It's, in fact, mapped basically the same in every program, but it's mapped kernel mode only, so it can put its exception table there, its exception handlers there, have the processor read them, and have them be used by the exception handlers, but not have to worry about me overwriting the timer interrupt handler, not by changing the exception table, but by editing the actual exception table, the OS set, or the actual code it's going to run. And I mentioned that when you try to do one of these privileged operations, which includes accessing this kernel-only memory, or doing other privileged instructions, you get a fault, you get an exception. That type of exception is a fault by this categorization. It's an error or an event in the program that wasn't just meant to trigger an exception. So for example, if we try to write memory that we don't own, you know, bad address, e.g. kernel only, we'll get a protection fault. The OS gets to decide what to do. It can crash your program. It can decide to like emulate the RAID or something like that. If we try to do other things, like we try to access the I/O devices directly, we'll get this protection fault. The OS gets to decide what to do. Probably it crashes your program. Maybe you could say, oh, you're trying to read from the keyboard. Let me do that for you if it wanted to. But the OS gets control. It gets to decide what to do. So since all these operations, some of which we might want to do, cause faults, like accessing I/O devices, let's talk about how we actually do those operations. How do we read from the keyboard? I said we do a system call, which is a deliberately triggered exception. So we have some instruction that does this. And we're going to use these all the time because there's lots of things we want to do that require privileged instructions. If we want to allocate memory, at some point we need to change our address space to have more things mapped to memory. And that's going to involve a privileged instruction. We can't just change address spaces all over the place because then I could just read whatever memory I wanted. So I have to have the OS do that for me. If I want to read, write to a file, I need to communicate with the hard drive. I'm not allowed to do that directly. I have to ask the OS to do it for me. I want to read from the keyboard, as we saw, I have to ask the OS to do it for me. I'm not allowed to communicate directly with the keyboard. So all these operations that require the OS's support, because they involve privileged instructions, like changing the address space, communicating with I/O devices, and so on, are going to involve running code in kernel mode. And because we need code in kernel mode, the only way we can have the OS do that for us is by having an exception happen. And this is where we're going to use a trap. And this is why we can't just use a normal function call. A normal function call is not going to enter kernel mode. It's going to run code in user mode. Yes, we can write all the instructions we want, but if we try to run them, they won't work. We'll just trigger an exception fault. So conceptually, these traps look kind of like a function call, but they have the most important difference that they actually run code in kernel mode. And let's talk about, for sake of example, what 64-bit Linux does to do system calls. So in x86 64 Linux, system calls are done with a special instruction, which is called syscall. So this is an instruction that exists only to trigger exceptions. That's the only thing it does. There's no other use for the instruction. So it triggers a trap, there's a deliberate exception, and this is what we use to run the OS and say, hey OS, I have something I want you to do for me. And just like a function call, there's a calling convention for system calls in Linux. And the most notable difference from a function call is that while we have multiple things we might want to do, so like we might want to, you know, say read, write, and so on, you know, allocate memory, you know, each type of operation we have will have a number. And the convention on Linux, which is just a convention like a calling convention, they've just chosen to do this, is that REX contains this number indicating the kind of operation you want to do. And then we have some registers that contain the arguments for that operation. And in the exception handler for system calls, it's going to look at REX and these arguments and decide what to do on behalf of the process that was running. So if we ask to read from the keyboard, it's going to say, oh, you asked for a read. You asked to read from the keyboard based on your arguments. Let me do that for you. And after it does that, we're going to return from the exception. And when we return, the convention is that RAX has a return value. And on an error, we're going to signal every error by just setting a return value that's a negative number. This is what Linux has chosen to do. And it wasn't just an arbitrary choice. But you can see that the choice they made is generally to make it look very much like a function call, just with this extra system call number. So it works almost the same like as a normal function call. It's not quite the same because we have this REX, the arguments might be, you know, slightly different choices. So it's basically the same idea. So let me show you what it looks like if we're just using these directly. So here I have some code which prints hello world and xsets without using the C library, you know, printf and so on, just using system calls directly. So the first thing we do is we set our system call number for write. We're doing a write operation. And the write system call in Linux happens takes three arguments, the first of which is where to write to. Each location to write to has a number known as a file descriptor. And by convention, file descriptor 1 is standard output, the normal output of your program to the terminal if you're writing from a terminal. So we set that to 1. The second argument is the string to write. And the third argument is the length of that string. Because we can write null characters, we have to specify a length. We don't write null characters in this case, but we could. So I'm specifying the string hello world. I'm saying it's 15 characters I want to write. And then I make the syscall. So I set up all the arguments like a function call, but rather than calling directly, I use syscall. And inside the kernel, it's going to look at the operating system. It's going to look at RAX and say, OK, you want to do a write. Let me look for the file descriptor number in RDI. Let me look for the string you want to write in RSI, and so on. And after that syscall completes, you know, it returns to here. And we run this move 60 into RAX. 60 is the system call number for xset. And then we move 0 into RDI, indicating that we want to exit with code 0. This tells the program running us that we terminated normally. And we exit. You'd say, well, why didn't you just return? So first thing to notice is that this is not main. So when your C programs have main, that's called by some code provided by your compiler. And that code does is it runs main, gets its return value, and then calls the exit syscall for you. But if you don't have a main, which is what I'm writing here, that's why it's not called main up there. I'm writing this without any support from that compiler code. I need to tell the OS, hey, I'm done. You need to do something about my program. And I use a system call to do that, because I can't do it myself. I can't get rid of a program. That's not operation I have permission to do. I have to access the OS's memory to do that. And I also can't like start another program running. I have to ask the OS to do that for me. So I need to make a system call to do that. So any questions about this code? Yes?
What would happen if you didn't
put that? So what would happen if I didn't put this here is the question. So the question is, what's in memory after this? Right. And there's going to be something there. And the processor is just going to interpret it as instructions and see what happens. And maybe eventually, if it's all valid instructions, we'll get to a place where when we try to access that memory, it goes to trigger error. And that will cause a seg fault that way if all the instructions before them are somehow valid. But it's unlikely to cause our program to terminate normally. Okay, so that's the user side of it. If I'm writing a program, that's what happens rawly when I ask the OS to do something for me. In the OS, we have an exception handler. So our exception table has a pointer to the handler for the kind of exception for system calls. And this handler is going to save all the registers, and then it's going to probably use the system call number to look up in a table the handlers for each individual kind of system call. So we kind of have a table that points to our system call handler, and our system call handler uses another table to figure out what to do for each particular kind of system call. And this is the typical implementation you'll see of system calls in pretty much any operating system. What the system calls do will vary, the calling convention will vary, whether it's documented how you use them directly will vary, but it's basically the same idea as far as how we request the OS do something on behalf of a program. And I showed you here that we had a system call for write and for exit. Those are important things. There are, of course, system calls for all those other things we need to do. So allocating memory. I can't change my own address space. And if I want more addresses to be valid, I need to ask the OS to do it. So there's system calls for that. In Linux, they're called mmap and break. If I want to create a new program, I need to let the OS know to schedule it when it gets another timer interrupt. I can't do that myself. That's some data structure in the OS, so I need to ask the OS to do that. So I use a system call for that. On Linux, that system call is called fork. If I want to start a program on disk running, conceptually I could like load it myself, but I probably want to ask the OS to do it because it has to set up a different address space mapping and so on. So I'm going to make a system call for that, and on Linux that's execve. And accessing files and a whole bunch of other things. Linux has like 200 plus system calls for various operations that we somehow want the operating system's help for. And the key thing about system calls and exceptions in general is that these exceptions are the only way to get into kernel mode. So the way the operating system controls what processes can do is by controlling what system calls let processes do and what every other kind of exceptions lets processes do. So as long as all those system call handlers and all the exception handlers for every single kind of exception are written very carefully, programs can't do things they're not supposed to. And this happens some of the time. But this is how the OS keeps programs from doing things, is by controlling what all the possible exceptions cause to happen, by just making sure the exception table doesn't point to any bad code. And because there's no other way to run in kernel mode, we can then rely on the fact that doing the dangerous things would require kernel mode to keep our programs in check, to know that, like, I can't read your files, for example. So I showed you what system calls look like sort of from an assembly perspective, but often you'll end up calling a C function which will say, or often be called like a system call, and it's not really because, well, you can't call system calls in the same way as C functions. But the libraries generally provide wrappers for system calls. So for example, there's a function called open in the standard library on Linux. And there's a system call called open. And the function called open, what it does, basically, is it sets the system call number register, REX, to the number for open, and then does a system call. So the idea is that you call this function open, and all this function open does is it makes the corresponding system call. And this is called a wrapper because it makes it look like a normal function, even though it's not a normal function. You can't call it with a call instruction. You can't call the real system call with a call instruction, but you can call this function with a call instruction. And there's also some other handling. So sometimes you might have to handle the arguments. In this case, we don't because they use the same registers. So RDI and RSI already have the values they should have. And Here, we do some handling of the error to set the error number in a different way. And as I said, this is a function that really exists in the C standard library on Linux. And this means that in normal code, you're going to do something where you call a function called open. And what that's going to do is that's just going to make the system call for open. So it's not that you're actually making a system call directly, but it's pretty close, because all this instruction function is doing is you're jumping to this move, moving a value into REX, and then a system call happens. But you don't get to do it directly because it wouldn't look like a function directly. But we have these simple wrappers which handle setting up the arguments and fixing up any return values so it looks like a function, but all that function does that you're actually calling is minimally wrap the real system call operation. Any questions about this? Some people look confused. So I'm mentioning this because you might see people refer to like the open system call and the read system call. And typically, if they're talking about like writing C code, this is what they're doing. They're not actually writing a syscall instruction. They're just using a library function that makes a system call. And they call it a system call because that's pretty much all that function does. It's not like printf, which does a whole lot of other stuff besides write. It computes strings and so on. Okay, so this is basically what I have on exceptions beyond one important note about the real world. So our textbook uses the term exception, interrupt, trap, and fault to have a very particular meaning. The real world is not so kind. In the real world, if you like pick up a processor manual, you'll see all sorts of definitions for these terms. They're all things related to exceptions, but different things. So for example, if you pick up the x86 manual, they'll call every type of exception an interrupt. They just use the word interrupt for all kinds of exceptions. If you pick up the x86 manual and you see the word exception, they don't mean all kinds of exceptions, they only mean faults. You might see some places where instead of using the word abort, they call it a hard fault. So the other kinds of faults, normal faults, are soft faults. You might see the word trap used to mean fault instead of using the word fault. And they'll call trap something else. So there's all this variation. Like, we're going to test you on the terms in the textbook if we ever ask you. But if you like pick up a processor manual or you're like looking at some documentation and you see these terms, you should figure out which ones they mean. Hopefully they'll tell you. In a processor manual, generally they'll define it clearly enough so you can figure it out. But there's a lot of variation in what terms are used for exceptions, depending on who's writing the documentation, depending on what architecture you're talking about. So just be aware of that. Don't be surprised if you see the word interrupt used to refer to things that we wouldn't call interrupts. We just want to distinguish between them. And generally, all these sources will have different names for each kind. They just might be different names. You know, they won't be the same names we use, but they will have a different term for interrupts than other kinds of exceptions, for example. It just might not be interrupt. Similarly, we use the term kernel mode. You might see some other names for that, supervisor mode, privileged mode, ring zero. At least you won't see kernel mode used to refer to something else. At least they always mean kernel mode, unlike with exceptions. But just be aware of that. Also, some systems have multiple levels of privilege. We're not going to talk about that much, but that's a thing that exists in hardware. That's why you sometimes see ring zero is referring to a system with that. Okay. So in our last 5 minutes, I'm going to talk a bit about more about address translation. So I mentioned that the way we implement this notion of an address space, the idea that each program sort of has an independent memory, can't interfere with other programs, and the OS gets to decide how much memory it has and what the layout is that the program addresses, these virtual addresses, go through this mapping set by the OS. and turn into real addresses. And note that this mapping, because there's some common confusion about this when people are working through problems, includes every address accessed, even the ones for code. Like, they're all memory accesses, everything goes through this mapping. And this mapping, you know, gives us virtual to physical. Those are the terms we're going to use. And note that because we have this mapping, they can be different sizes. So we can have, say, more virtual addresses than our possible physical addresses, so we can like have big holes in our address space and use just convenient numbers for memory addresses. Or maybe we'll have more physical addresses because we designed for 32-bit pointers, but we have more than 4 gigs of RAM. Right, they don't have to match up, and it can be convenient for them not to. So we're going to talk about what format we're going to use for this mapping. On typical processors, there's multiple choices, but there's one choice called paging or virtual memory or page tables that are commonly used today among every processor, which is basically the winner. So let's look at a toy example to illustrate, you know, what these page tables look like. So first, we're going to start off with a toy program memory. And I'm going to say, to keep things simple, on my system, programs have access to 10-bit addresses. So they have 2 to the 10 bytes of addresses they can potentially access. And we're going to divide these addresses, in this case, into 4 what we'll call pages. And I'll call them virtual pages because they're pages in the virtual addresses, the ranges of virtual addresses, not physical ones. And I'm going to number them 0 to 3. So I'm going to divide my memory into these pages. These are 2 to the 8 bytes each. And because I chose 2 to the 8 bytes, it happens that if I look at the upper bits of my address, I have a page number, because my page size is a power of 2. And we're going to have page number 0, 1, 2, 3. And we can just get that from the upper bits of the address because of the size I chose. And we're going to call the rest of the address a page offset. It's just going to be a name we're going to use for the part that's where are we within a page. And I'm going to say for this toy example that my physical memory is going to be a bit bigger. But I'm going to have physical addresses, which are 13 bits instead of 12. And just like I did with my virtual addresses, I'm going to divide this up into pages, each of which is 2 to the 8 bytes. And I'm going to number these again. I have 0, 1, up to 7. And just like I could with my virtual pages, I can figure out the page number by looking at the upper bits, because I chose 2 to the 8 bytes per page. And I'm going to choose a mapping. And the way I'm going to represent that mapping is I'm going to take whole pages of virtual addresses and map them to a whole page of physical addresses. And I'm going to write this mapping down in a table. And this is going to be called a page table. And this is how I'm going to tell the processor about the mapping. And this is where we'll pick up on Thursday. So before, since in my last minute, any questions about any exception related things or this picture? Okay, so good luck with the lab. Please actually work on the homeworks and so on.